Genesis 49, verses 13 through 27 is how far I'm going to read. We'll only get us, like I said, as far as verse 18. In verse 13, as Jacob is prophesying about his sons and what's going to happen to them in the future and their tribes, it says, Zebulun shall dwell at the shore of the sea. He shall become a haven for ships, and his border shall be at Sidon. Issachar is a strong donkey. Crouching between the sheepfolds, he saw that a resting place was good and that the land was pleasant, so he bowed his shoulder to bear and became a servant at forced labor. Dan shall judge his people as one of the tribes of Israel. Dan shall be a serpent in the way, a viper by the path, that bites the horse's heels so that his rider falls backwards. I wait for your salvation, O Lord. Raiders shall raid Gad, but he shall raid at their heels. Asher's food shall be rich, and he shall yield royal delicacies. Naphtali is a doe let loose that bears beautiful fawns. Joseph's a fruitful bough by a spring. His branches run over the wall. The archers bitterly attacked him, shot at him, and harassed him severely. Yet his bow remained unmoved. His arms were made agile by the hands of the mighty one of Jacob. From there is the shepherd, the stone of Israel. By the God of your father who will help you, by the Almighty who will bless you with blessings of heaven above, blessings of the deep that crouches beneath, blessings of the beasts in the womb, the blessings of your father are mighty beyond the blessings of my parents, up to the bounties of the everlasting hills. May they be on the head of Joseph and on the brow of him who was set apart from his brothers. Benjamin is a ravenous wolf. In the morning, devouring the prey, and at evening, dividing the spoil. Now, since we're only going as far as verse 18 tonight, you're probably wondering, why did you read all the way to verse 27? I wanted you to notice, I don't know if you caught this yet or not, as we've been looking at this, some of the guys he talks about in great, wonderful ways. Others, not so good. And he's prophesying and saying certain things, but we'd think, well, he's talking good about his favorite son and not his not favorite sons, not so well. But did you notice that Benjamin came from Rachel as well? And as much as he bragged on Joseph, he says Benjamin is a ravenous wolf. So as you're going to see, hopefully, as we've already touched on last week and we'll continue to look at tonight and next week as well, as we continue to break these down, God is the one speaking through Jacob. Jacob is prophesying and he's blessing his sons, yet at the same time, in doing so, he's talking about what's going to happen to them in days to come. And God's the only one that knows that. Jacob doesn't know half of this stuff. I mean, Jacob's already talking about where they're going to live. Has anybody thought about the fact that it is going to be between 400 and 500 years later that Zebulun is going to get their territory, and Issachar their territory, and so on. Yet here Jacob, almost 500 years before they actually go into the promised land, remember they're going to be in slavery in Egypt for 400 years, almost 500 years later, beforehand, he's prophesying about where their boundaries are going to be. How does he know that? Well, the only answer is God speaking through him right now. And that's one thing we need to keep in mind as we break these down. So let's take a look at what's being prophesied here, and we'll just deal tonight with Zebulun, Issachar, and Dan, and as you'll soon see, there's plenty to look at with these three. Look again at Zebulun, chapter 49, verse 13. Zebulun shall dwell at the shore of the sea. He shall become a haven for ships, and his border shall be at Sidon. Now, there's not a lot here in this one verse about what Jacob says about Zebulun, but a deeper dive into this topic in the whole of Scripture is going to unlock a lot more. And actually, it's going to cause some questions that we're going to have to wrestle with. As we've been doing all along, we're comparing Genesis 49 with Deuteronomy 33. So go to Deuteronomy 33 and look at what Moses says about Zebulun, and you'll see a similarity as well. Deuteronomy 33, verses 18 and 19. In Deuteronomy 33, verse 18, it says, "And of Zebulun, he said, rejoice, Zebulun, in your going out, and Issachar, in your tents. They shall call peoples to their mountain, and there they offer right sacrifices, for they draw from the abundance of the seas, and the hidden treasures of the sand. So we again see that in Genesis 49, Jacob talks about how Zebulun's going to dwell at the shore of the sea, going to be a haven for ships. His border is going to be at Sidon. Moses, under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, says that Zebulun and Issachar are going to call people to their mountain, and they're going to offer right sacrifices, and they're going to draw from the abundance of the seas and the hidden treasures of the sand. I want you to go also with me to Matthew chapter 4. In Matthew chapter 4, as Jesus is beginning his ministry in Capernaum, in Galilee, on the shores of the Sea of Galilee, Matthew points out that Jesus is starting his ministry up there as a fulfillment of a prophecy in Isaiah 9, 1 and 2. I'm not going to have you turn to Isaiah 9, 1 and 2 because you're going to see it quoted here in Matthew 4. But look at Matthew 4, verses 12 through 16. In Matthew chapter 4, starting in verse 12, it says, "Now when he," this is Jesus, "heard that John had been arrested, he withdrew into Galilee, and leaving Nazareth, he went and lived in Capernaum by the sea, in the territory of" who? "Zebulun and Naphtali, so that what might be spoken by the prophet Isaiah might be fulfilled." And here's Isaiah 9, 1 and 2, "The land of Zebulun, the land of Naphtali, the way of the sea beyond the Jordan, Galilee of the Gentiles, the people dwelling in darkness have seen a great light, and for those dwelling in the region and shadow of death, on them a light has dawned." So now we have seen three places where this prophecy and the quoting of the prophecies are saying that Zebulun's territory is going to be by the sea. Now let's go and look at when they get their land in Joshua chapter 19, and let's see where it is. In Joshua 19, verses 10 through 16, is when Zebulun, again, between 400 and 500 years later after Jacob's prophecy, that's when they finally get their territory. Joshua chapter 19, verses 10 through 16. Said, "The third lot came up for the people of Zebulun, according to their clans, and the territory of their inheritance reached as far as Sered. Then their boundary goes up westward and on to Merail and touches Dabbesheth. Then the brook that is east of Jokneam, from Sered it goes in the other direction, eastward toward the sunrise, to the boundary of Chisloth Tabor. And there, from there it goes to Dabarath, then up to Japhia. From there it passes along on the east toward the sunrise, to Gath Epher, to Ephkazin, and going on to Rimmon, it bends toward Nea. Then on the north, the boundary turns about to Hanathon, and it ends at the valley of Iphtahel, and Katah, and Nahalal, Shimron, Idalah, and Bethlehem, 12 cities with their villages. This is the inheritance of the people of Zebulun, according to their clans, these cities with their villages." Okay, I'm glad we read that, because now we know exactly where they are. That cleared it all up, didn't it? I mean, come on, it's right there next to Iphtahel, and I mean, come on, don't you know where that is? Well, what we do then is we go to our Bibles, because in the back they're going to have maps. Sylvia had her map out already tonight beforehand doing study, and she ran across a problem that we are going to wrestle with. Has anybody looked at your map where Zebulun is?
It's probably not there.
Well, no, it's there, but it doesn't touch any sea. It's landlocked. Well, how are we going to deal with this? Well, I'm going to help you out in a lot of ways. One, let me take you back to my seminary days. Remember, I shared with you a while back about how I came to realize that there are earlier manuscripts and later manuscripts and how I found that out. Well, there's a class that I took when I was in seminary that I hope none of you ever have to take. It was called Biblical Geography. One of the hardest classes you'll ever take in your entire life. You know why? You had to learn where all the cities were in Israel, but the problem was they moved. You had to, and they changed names, and you had to learn this is what the map looked like from this time period to this time period, but from this time period to this time period, this is what the map looked like. And I'm going to tell you something that hopefully you already know. You know the maps you have in your Bible? They're not inspired. So don't build where you think Zebulun is according to the maps that you have in your Bible. They're not inspired. They're helpful in some ways, but in other ways, they're not. And if we're going to be faithful to the word of God, Jacob prophesied that they'd be by the shore of the sea. Moses said that they would get their living from the sea. And Matthew, quoting from Isaiah 9, 1 and 2, as Jesus began his ministry along the shore of the Sea of Galilee, he actually said, that's where their territory is going to be. So just because your map says that it's not there, that doesn't mean that it supersedes what God's word says. Now, at the same time, there's this historian, he's a Jewish historian, he worked around the time of Rome's empire, if you will, when they took over Jerusalem and all. His name was Josephus, and he's actually a very well-known historian, and a lot of Bible scholars look up at what he does a lot. Now, again, Josephus is not inspired either. Josephus is a great resource for historical background, but one of the problems with Josephus was he was a Jew who worked for the Romans, but he was trying to make the Jews look good, so sometimes he was very political, and he would embellish to make the Jews look better. So being a historian that embellishes, it makes it a little bit tricky, but there's a lot of stuff that we can get. And Josephus actually says that Zebulun's territory went from the Mediterranean Sea to the Sea of Galilee. Interesting. Again, Josephus is not inspired. And there's one other way we can try to put this all together. Whether it touched the sea or not, and I believe it did at some point, definitely during the time of Jesus' ministry. No matter what, they did live and prosper by the sea, that as Moses prayed, since the major trade route called the Via Maris went straight through their land. There was a major, major trade route that went from the Sea of Galilee, from the Mediterranean Sea to the Sea of Galilee, and it was called the Via Maris, and it went right through Zebulun's territory. So they did live by the sea in the sense of enjoying the sea and all that came from it. But at the same time, if Matthew said that Jesus is walking on the shore of the sea and he's doing his ministry in the land of Zebulun, Zebulun at one time was by the sea. All right? Again, believe the Bible, don't believe the maps. Believe the Bible, don't believe just Josephus 100%, okay? Now, let's go to Issachar, Genesis 49, verses 14 and 15. By the way, that was the easy one. The hard one's going to be Dan when we get to Dan. Genesis 49, verses 14 and 15. Issachar is a strong donkey, crouching between the sheepfolds. He saw that a resting place was good and that the land was pleasant, so he bowed his shoulder to bear and became a servant at forced labor. In the Hebrew, this is, again, a little easier to grasp, but Jacob described his son Issachar and his descendants as hardy, strong, wise, and not afraid of hard work. I'm going to say that again. When he talks about him being a donkey, it doesn't mean that he's rebellious. It means he's a strong donkey. And if you know, donkeys were used for work. And he saw that the land was good and the resting place was good and pleasant. So he bowed his shoulder to bear and became a servant at forced labor. The name Issachar actually means man of wages. Issachar would be what we would call a blue-collar worker. The men of Issachar were known to not be afraid to go into battle. They weren't afraid of work. They actually, as you're going to see in just a second, were very wise and knew what to do. By the way, you can probably think of someone like that. They're not going to be the one that's going to be up front and preaching and teaching, but they're going to be godly, quiet, hardworking, common sense, people that know what to do. I got to be honest with you. I married a girl whose dad is one of them. He's 85 years old, and he's happier working He's not one of these flashy people. Give you an idea what he's like. My wife went up with one of our daughters to just go see her folks. They live about 3 hours away outside of Gainesville, and she went up there to just go visit them because her parents are getting older, and she's just going to regularly check on them and all. And when she got there, her dad was driving down the road of their property with his bobcat with all these huge logs in the front of his bobcat. And she said, "Dad, what are you doing?" He said, "Well, there was a tree that fell on a neighbor's property, and it's been sitting there for weeks. And finally, I just went and knocked on their door and said, 'What do you want to do about that tree?' They said, 'We'd love it if somebody would take care of it.' And he said, 'I'll do it free of charge if you let me have the wood, because I'm going to use it for my fireplace.' It has taken him weeks. It was a huge tree. But at 85 years old, he's happy as a clam. Every day going out there for a few hours and cutting it apart and then taking it back with his bobcat and splitting it himself. And he doesn't have a power splitter. He's got the old mallet. And he's happy. But you know what? If you ever knew how to get something fixed or do it, that's him. Go to Deuteronomy chapter 33 again, and look at verses 18 and 19. We've just read it, but you were looking for Zebulun, so you missed it. In Deuteronomy 33, Issachar was mentioned in there as well. Deuteronomy 33, verses 18 and 19. And of Zebulun, he said, "Rejoice, Zebulun, in your going out, and who? Issachar, in your tents. They shall call peoples to their mountain. There they offer right sacrifices." That means they're righteous. "For they draw from the abundance of the seas and the hidden treasures of the sand." Go to 1 Chronicles chapter 7. 1 Chronicles chapter 7, verses 1 through 5. In 1 Chronicles chapter 7, look at verses 1 through 5. It says, "The sons of Issachar, Tola, Pua, Jashub, and Shimron," that was four, "the sons of Tola, Uzi, Rephaiah, Jeriel, Jamai, Ibsam, and Shemuel, heads of their father's houses, namely of Tola, mighty warriors of their generation, their number in the days of David being 22,600, the son of Uzi, Izrahiah, and the sons of Izrahiah are Michael, Obadiah, Joel, and Ishiah. All five of them were chief men, and along with them, by their generations, according to their fathers' houses, were the units of the army for war, 36,000, for they had many wives and sons. Their kinsmen belonging to all the clans of Issachar were 87,000 mighty warriors enrolled in genealogy." So here, first off, we see that the men of Issachar were mighty men of war. But there's one other thing that the scripture tells us. Go to 1 Chronicles chapter 12. 1 Chronicles chapter 12, look at one verse, verse 32. It says, "Of Issachar, men who had understanding of the times to know what Israel ought to do, 200 chiefs and all their kinsmen under their command." Now, we've already seen when we're looking at Reuben, how Reuben, when Deborah, because there was no male judge at the time, nobody was willing to work for God, and she was the one who had to take charge at that time. When she finally talked Barak into helping her in the battle, they rounded up some people from Israel. And remember when we were looking at Reuben, how Reuben was like, "Eh, I had great searching of heart." But in that whole passage, it said Issachar, their guys were glad to be a part of the battle. These type of people are very needed. Hardworking, full of wisdom, and common sense. Now, by the way, this isn't only men. There's a lot of ladies that are that way, too. I'll be honest with you. Over the years, as a pastor, especially when I started young, I started full-time preaching when I was 19. I would look in churches for these type of people because they were never going to come to me, but I could go to them and look for wisdom and counsel. They knew what to do. They had wisdom. And now, don't think that these are the best people. We need all types. A lot of us, we're out there watching the rocket going to the moon today. Thank God for the people that can do that kind of math. A lot of them are friends of mine, go to First Baptist Merritt Island. I know a lot of guys that work out there at the Space Center, and I joke with them all the time and say, how do you calculate geographic features and gravitational pulls and rotation of the Earth, and you got all those satellites zipping everywhere? He goes, yeah, it takes a lot of math. That stuff makes my head hurt. They're not the guy that's going to go dig a ditch, but they're gifted in another way. You got some of us that aren't good for much except yapping. Do you realize, just like your body's made up of all different parts and they all work together, we need each other. We need each other. And the men of Issachar, they were hardworking, full of wisdom and common sense. We're going to remember them at the very end of our study tonight. Now, I've saved most of our time, though, tonight for Dan. Go to Genesis 49. Look at verses 16 through 18. It says, Dan shall judge his people as one of the tribes of Israel. Dan shall be a serpent in the way, a viper by the path, that bites the horse's heels so that his rider falls backward. I wait for your salvation, O Lord. This is a very interesting one. Let me read it again. Keep in mind, Jacob is now speaking to his 12 sons. As they all line up to hear what Dad's going to say about them, he says, Dan shall judge his people as one of the tribes of Israel. But then he goes on and says, Dan shall be a serpent in the way, a viper by the path, that bites the horse's heels so that his rider falls backwards. And then he makes a very interesting statement, I wait for your salvation, O Lord. Now, Dan's history is sad. It's a sad one. And his future is a bit cloudy. We're going to see that in just a little bit. So let's see what the Bible has to say about Dan. Well, Jacob said that he's going to judge his people as one of the tribes of Israel. And actually, does anybody know what the word Dan means? Judge. By the way, remember Daniel? You know what Daniel's name means? God is my judge. Daniel, you ever noticed how El has been added? Michael, Gabriel, the angels are named after God. Well, Daniel means God is my judge. Dan means judge. And actually, there was one of the judges in Israel that came from the tribe of Dan. Anybody know who it is? Somebody guessed it right last night. I heard it over here. Samson. Samson came from the tribe of Dan. Go with me to Judges chapter 13. Judges 13, verses 1 through 5. Robert either has been reading his Bible or he already listened to last night's recording, so I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt. He's got a good memory. There you go. That's good. Judges 13, look at verses 1 through 5. And the people of Israel again did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, so the Lord gave them into the hand of the Philistines for 40 years. As you're going to see, by the way, the tribe of Dan was given the territory by the Philistines. That's where they were originally given their territory. Things are going to change, as you'll see tonight. There was a certain man of Zora of the tribe of who? The Danites, whose name was Manoah, and his wife was barren and had no children. And the angel of the Lord appeared to the woman and said to her, Behold, you are barren and have not borne children, but you shall conceive and bear a son. Therefore, be careful and drink no wine or strong drink and eat nothing unclean. For behold, you shall conceive and bear a son. No razor shall come upon his head, for the child shall be a Nazarite to God from the womb, and he shall begin to save Israel from the hand of the Philistines. Now, if you know anything about Samson, yes, he became a judge in Israel, but he wasn't known for his morality, was he?
No.
He had a problem with women. And even though he was gifted by God and he did judge Israel for a season, because of his morality issues, he lost it as well. And they were also given their allotted territory by Joshua in the area of the Philistines, but they didn't like it. So they moved north and destroyed a peaceful people and took their land and they named it Dan. You say, where do you get this? Well, from the Bible. Go with me to Joshua chapter 19. Joshua 19, verses 40 through 48 is where they're given their territory. When, remember, when they passed it out, it was given by lot, which means they cast the lot and the Lord showed where they were to go. Joshua 19, verses 40 through 48 says, the seventh lot came out for the tribe of the people of Dan, according to their clans, and the territory of its inheritance included Zorah, Eshtaol, Ir Shemesh, Shalabin, Ajalon, Ithla, Elon, Timnah, Ekron, El Tekeh, Gibbethon, Baalath, Jehud, Beneberak, Gath-Rimmon, and Me-Jarkon, and Rakon, with the territory over against Joppa, that's where the Philistines are. When the territory of the people of Dan was lost to them, the people of Dan went up and fought against Leshem, and after capturing it and striking it with the sword, they took possession of it and settled in it, calling Leshem Dan after the name of Dan, their ancestor. This is the inheritance of the tribe of the people of Dan, according to their clans, these cities with their villages. So we see something here, that they were given their area in the land of the Philistines, but they lost it. Well, how'd they lose it? Well, they lost it in a lot of ways. They lost it because, remember how God had told them, don't be afraid, be courageous and strong as you go in. If you are with me, I'm going to be with you, and you're going to defeat your enemies, and you're going to take over. But they, as you're going to see, got corrupted by the people around them. They intermarried with the people around them. They began to worship their gods, and they were defeated by the people that they were supposed to go conquer. And as you're going to see in Judges, go to Judges chapter 18. I'm going to read to you the whole chapter. There's a story that shows how they went from where they were in Dan, or sorry, where they were in the area of the Philistines, to the north, to the area now called, or then at the time as well, called Dan, where they renamed it. But as you're going to see, they went against the people that were unsuspecting. They were peaceful, and they just went and took their land. Not a section that God had cast lots for them to have. Go to Judges 18. We're going to start with verse 1. In those days, there was no king in Israel, and in those days, the tribe of the people of Dan was seeking for itself an inheritance to dwell in. Well, hang on, stop for a second. Why were they seeking for themselves an inheritance to dwell in when way back in Joshua, they had already been given an inheritance to dwell in? They lost it because of sin. For until then, no inheritance among the tribes of Israel had fallen to them. Not true. They had had it. But as you're going to see what happens next. So the people of Dan sent 5 able men from the whole number of their tribe, from Zorah, from Eshtaol, to spy out the land and explore it. And they said to them, go and explore the land. And they came to the hill country of Ephraim, to the house of Micah, and lodged there. When they were by the house of Micah, by the way, this is not the prophet Micah that we have in our Bible, they recognized the voice of the young Levite. And they turned aside and they said to him, who brought you here? What are you doing in this place? What is your business here? And he said to them, this is how Micah dealt with me. He hired me, and I have become his priest. And they said to him, inquire of God, please, that we may know whether the journey on which we're setting out will succeed. And the priest said to them, go in peace. The journey in which you go is under the eye of the Lord. Then the 5 men departed and came to Laish and saw people, the people who were there, how they lived in security after the manner of the Sidonians, quiet and unsuspecting, lacking nothing that is in the earth and possessing wealth, and how they were far from the Sidonians and had no dealings with anyone. And when they came to their brothers at Zorah and Eshtaol, their brothers said to them, what do you report? They said, arise, let us go up against them, for we have seen the land, and behold, it's very good, and will you do nothing? Do not be slow to go enter in and possess the land. As soon as you go, you'll come into an unsuspecting people. The land is spacious, for God has given it into your hands, a place where there is no lack of anything that's in the earth. So 600 men of the tribe of Dan, armed with weapons of war, set out from Zorah and Eshtaol and went up and encamped at Kiriath Jearim in Judah. On this account, that place is called Mahanah Dan to this day. Behold, it is west of Kiriath Jearim. And they passed on from there to the hill country of Ephraim and came to the house of Micah. Then the five men who had gone to scout out the country of Laish said to their brothers, "Do you know that in these houses there's an ephod, household gods, a carved image, and a metal image? Now therefore consider what you will do." And they turned aside there and came to the house of the young Levite at the home of Micah and asked him about his welfare. Now the 600 men of the Danites, armed with their weapons of war, stood by the entrance of the gate. And the five men who had gone to scout out the land went up and entered and took the carved image in the ephod, the household gods, and the metal image, while the priest stood by the entrance of the gate with the 600 men, armed with weapons of war. And when these went into Micah's house and took the carved image, the ephod, the household gods, and the metal image, the priest said to them, "What are you doing?" And they said to him, "Keep quiet, put your hand on your mouth, and come with us, and be to us a father and a priest. Is it better for you to be a priest of the house of one man, or to be the priest to a tribe and the clan in Israel?" And the priest's heart was glad. He took the ephod and the household gods and the carved image and went along with the people. So they turned and departed, putting the little ones and the livestock and the goods in front of them. And when they had gone a distance from the home of Micah, the men who were in the houses near Micah's house were called out, and they overtook the people of Dan. And they shouted to the people of Dan, who turned around and said to Micah, "What is the matter with you that you come with such a company?" And he said, "You take my gods that I made and the priest and go away, and what have I left? How then do you ask me, 'What's the matter with you?'" And the people of Dan said to him, "Do not let your voice be heard among us, lest angry fellows fall upon you and you lose your life with the lives of your household." Then the people of Dan went their way, and when Micah saw that they were too strong for him, he turned and went back to his home. But the people of Dan took what Micah had made and the priests who belonged to him, and they came to Laish, to a people quiet and unsuspecting, and struck them with the edge of the sword and burned the city with fire. And there was no deliverer, because it was far from Sidon, and they had no dealings with anyone. It was in the valley that belongs to Beth Rehob. Then they rebuilt the city and lived in it, and they named the city Dan, after the name of Dan their ancestor, who was born to Israel. But the name of the city was Laish at the first. And the people of Dan set up the carved image for themselves, and Jonathan, their son, the son of Gershom, son of Moses, and his sons were priests to the tribe of the Danites until the day of the captivity in the land. So they set up Micah's carved image that he made as long as the house of God was at Shiloh. Do the Danites sound like a great group of guys? Let me give you a little recap of what you just read, or I read to you. There was this Levite who was a priest, and he was walking along one day, and this guy Micah says, "What are you doing?" He says, "Well, not much." He says, "Why don't you come to work for me and be my own personal priest? I'll pay you." Okay. So the guy goes to work for this guy, Micah. Oh, Micah, he's not only wanting him to be his priest before God, he's also got his carved images and his ephods and all this stuff, and he's worshiping many gods. Well, the Danites, by the way, remember back in Joshua 19, you can go double check me, when I read all those names and butchered them of the places that they were given as their inheritance? Was any of them Laish? No, none of them were called Laish. They were given, and actually, as we read, they went back to those couple of the towns that they had been given in Joshua 19 to go talk with the guys before they left there. And they sent five guys to go spy out another place to live because they had been defeated because of their sin by the Philistines. And so these guys go and they see this priest who works for Micah, and they said, "Hey, prophesy for us, tell us, pray to God, will this go well for us?" And he said, "Yeah, go, God's with you." By the way, Just because someone said God's in it doesn't mean God's in it. You've seen false prophets in the Old Testament, haven't you? Remember how Jeremiah was prophesying that this ain't going to end good for y'all, but all the other prophets were all saying, oh, it's going to be fine. We're going to be defeating them and all this stuff. So just because he said God said go doesn't mean God said go. One of the ways you'll know is this guy's talking to carved images and ephods and all that kind of stuff and metal images. So they go up and scout the land, and they find these people that are unsuspecting. They got no help. They're living at peace. It's not the area God gave them, at least not yet. And they decide we're gonna go conquer them. So they go back and round up 600 men. And on the way, they go to Micah's place, and they round up this priest, and they say to him, would you rather work for one guy or work for a whole tribe? Why don't you come work for us? And while you're at it, let's steal those gods out of that Micah's house. And as they go, Micah realizes what's going on. He gets a group of guys, and they come to meet him and say, what are you doing? And he pretty much said to him, you know, you'll do well to shut your mouth, because you may end up dead if you say much more. We're going to do this, and you can't stop us. And they realized they were too strong, and they went up there and defeated the people of Laish and took their land and renamed it Dan. Has anybody ever been to Israel? One of the places you go is Dan. And what's one of the stops when you go on a tour of Israel and they take you to Dan? What's one of the places they take everybody to? There's a big cavern, and it's the place where they had set up the golden calf in Dan. I've been there. They've actually built seating around where the altar was. Well, let's read about that. Go to 1 Kings chapter 12. See, Dan's not done being a serpent in the way. Yeah, Dan was a judge, but Dan also was kind of wicked and caused many in Israel to sin. Look at 1 Kings 12, 25 through 33. Then Jeroboam built Shechem in the hill country of Ephraim and lived there. And he went out from there and he built Penuel. And Jeroboam said in his heart, now the kingdom will turn back to the house of David. If this people go up to offer sacrifices in the temple of the Lord at Jerusalem, then the heart of this people will turn again to their Lord, to Rehoboam, the king of Judah, and they will kill me and return to Rehoboam, king of Judah. So the king took counsel and made two calves of gold, and he said to the people, you have gone up to Jerusalem long enough. Behold your gods, O Israel, who brought you out of the land of Egypt. And he set one in Bethel, and the other he put in Dan. Then this thing became a sin, for the people went as far as Dan to be before one. And he also made temples on the high places and appointed priests from among all the people who were not of the Levites. And Jeroboam appointed a feast on the 15th day of the eighth month, like the feast that was in Judah. Excuse me. And he offered sacrifices on the altar. So he did in Bethel, sacrificing to the calves that he had made, and he placed in Bethel the priest of the high places that he had made. He went up to the altar that he had made in Bethel on the 15th day of the eighth month, and in the month that he had devised from his own heart, and he instituted a feast for the people of Israel and went up to the altar to make offerings. So after the time that the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom divide, remember there was King David and there was a united kingdom in Israel, then Solomon and there was a united kingdom, but after Solomon died, all of a sudden, the kingdom gets divided, and Jeroboam is now king of the northern 10 tribes. Rehoboam is king of the southern two tribes, Judah and Benjamin. And Jeroboam of the northern says, God's law in Leviticus and repeated in Deuteronomy said that three times a year, the men at least had to go to Jerusalem for three feasts, the Feast of Passover, the Feast of Harvest, and the Feast of Booths. If they keep going down there to our enemy, their hearts are going to get turned back to God and not me. So we're going to make a place of worship up here in Dan and in Bethel so they don't have to go back to Jerusalem. And they made them calves of gold and said, here are the gods that brought you out of Egypt. Now, I'm thinking most of you know this is a major no-no, correct? I mean, what did they do when they came out of Egypt and Moses was up on the mountain getting the Ten Commandments? And they said, we don't know what happened to this Moses fellow. And they said, Aaron, hey, make us something we can worship. And he fashioned a calf of gold. God came down and was so angry he was going to wipe them all out. Yet, so many years later, they made calves of gold and set one up in Dan and one in Bethel. And I've been to the place where the altar of the golden calf was. Go ahead.
Is this the same area as Shiloh and Samaria?
North of it, even. Yes. Yep. But you remember how we talked about earlier, they talk about the land of Israel from Dan to Beersheba? Dan is the furthest north. Now, at the same time, we can see also from the scriptures, because of time, I'm not going to read them to you. I want you to just look them up later on. They don't mention any tribes per se as much as they're just talking about the northern tribes. During that time, many righteous people who were in the northern kingdom of Israel moved south to Judah and to Benjamin because their kings were still following God. During Rehoboam's time, write this down, look at it later on, 2 Chronicles chapter 11, verses 13 through 17. And during the time of Asa, the king after him, 2 Chronicles 15, 9. So during Rehoboam, it talks about this in 2 Chronicles 11, 13 through 17. And during the time of Asa, 2 Chronicles 15, 9. During those two godly kings in the southern kingdom, it talks about how many righteous people in the northern kingdoms just said, we can't be in this country anymore. We got to go down where people are worshiping God. It's kind of like how people change states according to the governments here in the United States. And I didn't name any names, all right? So, yes, sir.
So people are always looking to go ahead and worship something, right?
Oh, people are looking to worship. They're going to worship something. We're all created by God to worship. We've been made with a desire to worship, even if it's ourselves. Yep, without question. Now, before we deal with the real conundrum that comes up with Dan, that many Bible scholars have wrestled with for years, do you remember what Jacob said at the very end? He said, Dan's going to be a judge. It's one of the tribes of Israel. But Dan's also going to be a serpent in the way that strikes the horse's heel so that its rider falls backwards. In other words, he's going to cause a lot of people to fall. And we've already seen through their history, they did. But then he said this, remember? I wait for your salvation, O Lord. In other words, Lord, only you are going to be able to bring them back. Only you are going to be able to bring them back. Now, go to Revelation chapter 7. As you've heard me teach, as I've taught through the book of Revelation and read in our book on what will happen next, in Revelation chapter 7, we see the 144,000 Jewish witnesses. We know they're male Jews, 12,000 from each tribe, that at the beginning of the tribulation period are going to go out as witnesses over the whole globe. And the 12 tribes are mentioned very specifically in Revelation 7, verses 4 through 8. And I want you to notice who's missing, especially as we've been studying a guy named Dan. Look at chapter 7, starting in verse 4. And I heard the number of the sealed, 144,000, sealed from every tribe of the sons of Israel. 12,000 from the tribe of Judah were sealed. 12,000 from the tribe of Reuben. 12,000 from the tribe of Gad. 12,000 from the tribe of Asher. 12,000 from the tribe of Naphtali. 12,000 from the tribe of Manasseh. 12,000 from the tribe of Simeon. 12,000 from the tribe of Levi. 12,000 from the tribe of Issachar, 12,000 from the tribe of Zebulun, 12,000 from the tribe of Joseph, 12,000 from the tribe of Benjamin were sealed. Who's not mentioned?
Dan.
And this has been the big question that we're going to wrestle with in the time we have left. Why is Dan not mentioned in the very end when the 144,000 witnesses are going, 12,000 from each tribe. How come Dan's not one of the tribes? Now, some will say, well, wait a minute. I didn't see Ephraim. I saw Manasseh, but I didn't see Ephraim. Well, actually, you did see Ephraim. Joseph is Ephraim. Go to Numbers chapter 1. I'm going to remind you of this. Joseph and Ephraim are interchangeable. Numbers chapter 1. Look at verses 31 and 32, I think it is. Numbers chapter 1, starting in verse 32, actually, 32 and 33. Of the people of Joseph, namely of the people who? Of Ephraim. So Joseph and Ephraim are interchangeable. Their generations, by their clans, by their father's houses, according to the number of names from 20 years old and upward, every man able to go to war, those listed of the tribe of Ephraim were 40,500. So when we see the tribe of Joseph, it's talking about Ephraim. And keep this in mind, and this is going to help us maybe as we get to the end tonight. Remember when Jacob meets Joseph and his two sons that he had in Egypt, and he said, your two sons now, Ephraim and Manasseh, are mine, and they're going to carry on my name? Did anybody ever wrestle with the fact that all of a sudden Jacob has just made 13 tribes? Keep that in mind. So, why is Dan not mentioned in Revelation chapter 7? I'm going to give you four answers as possibilities. By the way, number four I'll give you first. We really don't know. All right, to be really honest with you, we really don't know. But there are some strong possibilities, some stronger than others, in my opinion. Number one, some people think the Antichrist is going to come from Dan. And that's why Dan's not mentioned. Again, they use the fact that he's going to be a serpent, by the way, in Genesis 49:17. Deuteronomy 33:22. We never did read Deuteronomy in Moses' statement about Dan. Go there real quick. Deuteronomy 33, look at verse 22. And of Dan, he said, Dan is a lion's cub that leaps from Bashan. Some people think that tied together with Genesis 49:17 says he's going to be a bad guy and the Antichrist is going to come from him. And they also take one more place. Go to Jeremiah chapter 8 and look at verses 14 through 17. Jeremiah 8, verses 14 through 17. Why do we sit still? Gather together, let us go into the fortified cities and perish there. For the Lord our God has doomed us to perish and has given us poisoned water to drink because we have sinned against the Lord. We looked for peace, but no good came, for a time of healing, but behold, terror. The snorting of their horses is heard from Dan. At the sound of the neighing of their stallions, the whole land quakes. They come and devour the land and all that fills it, the city and those who dwell in it. For behold, I'm sending among you serpents, adders that cannot be charmed, and they shall bite you, declares the Lord. So there are those who take this and they say, this is when the Antichrist is going to come, and the Antichrist is coming from Dan. Actually, I don't agree with that, and here's why. This passage is not talking about the latter days. It's Jeremiah's prophesying about the fact that Babylon is going to be coming from the north to take the rest of them captive. And by the way, who's in the north? I heard you. Dan. Remember? Northern to southern, Dan to Beersheba. When Jeremiah says they're coming from Dan, they're coming from the north. But there are those who try to make it that the Antichrist is going to come from the tribe of Dan. I personally don't lean on that one, but I gave it to you so you would at least have heard it. Number two, God may choose not to use them in the latter days simply because of their wickedness and their idolatry, but I can't go there either. Because if we're honest, name me one of the tribes that deserves to be in there. They've all been wicked and idolatrous. So have you and I. So to say that God, we can't use Dan because of their wickedness and their idolatry, well, we've already seen Reuben's not a great guy. I mean, we're going to get to it later on. Benjamin's a ravenous wolf. He doesn't want to have his soul come into the council of Simeon and Levi, yet Simeon's mentioned. So to say, Dan's not mentioned because of their wickedness. Now, I think there's another possibility. And if you ask me, this one I lean toward the most, probably just as much as number four. We don't know. But there's a chance that actually the tribe of Dan at the time of Revelation 7 doesn't exist. And there's a chance that the tribe of Dan doesn't exist now. Let me show you something interesting that I found in my study that I had never seen before. Someone else found it. That's how I found it. Go to 1 Chronicles chapter 4. We're not going to read the chapters, but I want you to start with me in 1 Chronicles chapter 4 and look at the headings. As you're turning there, you probably know this, but if you don't, let me fill you in. 1 and 2 Chronicles were written by Ezra after the Babylonian captivity. Remember, they're in Babylon for 70 years, and after that, they were allowed to go back to Jerusalem and rebuild the walls and all this stuff. Ezra and Nehemiah were a part of the rebuilding. Well, Ezra is the one who wrote 1 and 2 Chronicles. And look at what Ezra writes, starting with chapter 4. You see your heading. Chapter 4 starts with the descendants of who?
Judah.
By the way, that's one. Chapter 4, verse 24, the descendants of who?
Simeon.
There's two. Chapter 5, verse 1, descendants of who?
Reuben.
That's three. Chapter 5, verse 11, descendants of Gad. Four. There's Manasseh. And verse 23, I lost track. We have five now. Chapter 6, verse 1, descendants of Levi, 7, or 6. Chapter 7, verse 1,
Issachar.
Okay. Then you got chapter 7, verse 6, Benjamin. You got chapter 7, verse 13, Naphtali.
Manasseh.
Chapter 7, verse 14, Manasseh. Chapter 7, verse 20, Ephraim.
Asher.
Chapter 7, verse 30, Asher. Dan's not mentioned there either. There's a chance, and again, I don't want to take you even deeper. I could, but you already hate me as it is. But there's actually a statement made in 2 Chronicles talking about this one person whose father was a Danite, but whose mother was a Babylonian or whatever kind of a thing. In other words, there's a chance that the Danites, being as wicked as they were, so intermarried and intermingled, there's a chance by the time we get to the end, there are no Danites. And it's interesting that when Ezra, after the Babylonian captivity, is listing all the tribes, and he lists 12, Dan is not mentioned even there. Remember how I said earlier, it always has baffled me why Jacob would make 13 tribes? The Spirit of God might have had him know that there was going to be possibly one that would disappear. Remember, the real answer is we don't know. But if you had to ask me, I lean the most toward the fact that there is no more tribe of Dan, but they've been replaced by Ephraim and Manasseh. Interesting. Now, how do we tie this all together? How do we wrap this all up? Well, first and foremost, I put in my notes, may we look more like the men of Issachar than the people of Dan. Hopefully you get that one. But remember how we started this study? And how we reminded you again tonight, the study of Jacob prophesying and speaking over his sons, what's going to happen in days to come. Do you remember how we looked at the fact that he's saying a lot of stuff that there's no way he would know, but it's obvious God was speaking? And as I just hinted at with the possibility of why Jacob added two tribes and made 13, God knows the future. Would you not agree? We have a problem. We want to be God. We all want to know how it's going to work out. We want to know if this is, remember what the Danites asked? Is this going to go well for us? They were told, yeah, it's going to go well, even though the guy was lying. We want to know the future. But the longer I walk with the Lord and the more I study His Word, the more I've come to realize God doesn't want us to know the future as much as we want to know the future. What he's more interested in is that we walk with him a day at a time. I'm going to give you a little homework assignment. Some of you might already know about this, but if you don't, I want you to look this up. There's a poem written by a lady named Minnie Louise Haskins. Minnie Louise Haskins. The best way to find it is write her name down and then write the gate of the year. The title of the poem is God Knows, but if you just try to Google God Knows, you're going to find so much other stuff, it's going to confuse you. So do Minnie Louise Haskins' The Gate of the Year poem, but look for the full version. I'm going to quote to you the beginning of the poem. The full version, though, is absolutely profound. But the poem starts this way. She says, "So I said to the man at the gate of the year, give me a light that I might tread out into the unknown. And the man said to me, no, put your hand into the hand of God and then step out into the darkness, for this will be better for you than a light and a known way." And then she goes on in great prose to make statements like this. If we really believe that God knows the future and he loves us and he's in control, by the way, I'm paraphrasing. If we really believe that God knows the future and he loves us and he's in control, then fear is premature. And if you're honest, we all wrestle with that, don't we? I mean, we want to know why Dan's not mentioned. We want to figure it all out. There's nothing wrong with searching. But you also need to get to a point where if God doesn't give an answer, you're okay because you have peace. Peace that passes understanding. As we closed the study 2 weeks ago, a lady came up to me and she said, "I just found something in my Bible that you shared 9 years ago that you learned from your daughter." And I said, "Oh, I know what it was." She said, "What?" I said, "Oh, it's the story that I told about when I was a pastor in Chicago and we lived in the parsonage and had a long driveway in the mailbox at the end, and I wanted to walk with my daughter who was not even five, and me and Nicole, we were going to walk to go get the mail, but I mistakenly said, 'Nicole, let's go get the mail,' and she took off running, and I stood at the top of the driveway and I thought, I didn't need her to get the mail, I can go get the mail. And God spoke to my heart that day and said, 'Jim, do you see that girl running down the driveway? That's you. So I don't always tell you where we're going, because you'll try to go get there. I'm more interested in you holding my hand and the two of us enjoying the journey.'" So, of course, the next time when I wanted to hold my daughter's hand and get the mail, I didn't say, "Nicole, let's go get the mail." I said, "Let's go for a walk." Of course, I had in mind to go get the mail. What was her inevitable question? No, she said, "Where are we going?" And I, in another way, said, "None of your business." And I held her hand, and we began to walk down toward the mailbox. Of course, she's figured out where we're going, and she tries to go, but I've got a good grip on her. And the lady, I said, "That was what I shared 9 years ago, wasn't it?" She said, "Nope." I said, "What was it?" She said, "You shared with us that your daughter made this statement, 'It is not settled when we get an answer from God. It is settled when we have peace.'" I remembered that was something my daughter had learned, and it was profound. It's not settled when we get an answer. It's settled when we have peace. What does Jesus say to us? "In this world, you will have tribulation. In me, you'll have peace." Guys, ladies, we have a God who knows the future in a detail we couldn't even fathom. And it's all going to come out like he said. But we have a choice each day. Are we going to be Danites who make up our mind to do what we want instead of what God has in mind and go away from him and possibly miss out? Or are we going to be men of Issachar who are willing to be wise and know what the Lord wants us to do in the days that we're in? and just go live for him. Head out into the unknown, but first put your hand in the hand of God. That'll be better for you than a light and a known way. I love you. We'll see you next week. Thanks for coming. Thank you. Happy Easter as well.